Thank you to Wildcare and Wildlife Acoustics for sponsoring the Bat Chat podcast.
Can you hear that? We can. Wildlife Acoustics creates the world's leading bat acoustic monitoring tools, designed to help scientists make impactful discoveries for our biologically diverse planet, turning this into this. Visit wildlifeacoustics.com to learn more.
Wildcare are committed to supporting the ecology industry and are specialists in supplying a large range of monitoring, conservation and habitat management products, as well as equipment hire and service and repair. With a large range of products coupled with friendly and expert help and advice, Wildcare is a favourite supplier for ecologists nationwide. Go to wildcare.co.uk to see the full range and quote BatChat at the checkout for 10% off all bat detectors and bat boxes. Hello and welcome to this week's Bat Chat from the Bat Conservation Trust, bringing you the stories from the bat conservation movement. I'm Steve Rowe, and back in November, BCT hosted the second Woodland Symposium, 6 years after the inaugural symposium. It brought together landowners, ecologists, bat workers and professionals from the woodland and forestry industry to listen to talks from 15 speakers, covering research, knowledge updates and case studies on woodlands and bats. We hear from three of those speakers in this episode, as well as from a couple of the 11 students who had been given a place at the conference by bursaries offered by the Back from the Brink project. Check out episode 2 for more on that. We start off with Gareth Fisher from the RSPB discussing the Woodland Wildlife Toolkit. So Gareth, can you introduce yourself to the listeners? So what does your job entail? How did you find yourself working at the RSPB?
Hello, my name is Gareth Fisher and I'm an ecologist for the RSPB. The team that I work in provide ecological advice and support to our reserve staff and also now to our off-reserve projects as well. Within the team, I'm the lead on woodland habitats and species, and I'm also the chair of the RSPB's Woodland Nature Recovery Group. So I work with colleagues across the whole organisation whose focus is on woodlands. And when I'm not in woodlands, I spend a lot of time, usually, apart from obviously over the last few months, in North Wales, because I do a lot of work with the reserve team in North Wales. I came to work for the RSPB, actually, it suddenly occurred to me that it was 20 years ago, just over, that I did my first contract, and that was a summer project looking at lapwing over in West Wales, and then went back about 2 years after that and had, I think it was about 2.5-3 years of sort of winter and summer contracts pretty much across the whole of the of Britain, which was excellent. And then came to the ecology team in 2006 and I've been with them ever since.
Roughly how big's the ecology team at RSPB then?
It's about 20 people.
So presumably they're not just doing birds, they are doing all aspects of ecology, are they?
Yeah, we look at everything, basically. Obviously, if you're going to have a good bird population, you fundamentally need a good ecosystem. So, you know, we advise on priority species, and we've got a whole load of priority species and very important SSSI features, things like that, that cover invertebrates and plants, and we have quite a lot of, well, I think we do have all of the UK's bat species on our reserves in one place or another. We've got a couple that have pretty high numbers, and it's of 90% of all the bat species that we have on them. So we have to take everything into account. We're definitely not just a bird organisation, really. We do cover everything.
Great stuff. So we've just heard you at today's part of the Woodland Symposium talking about the Woodland Wildlife Toolkit. So can you just give us an introduction to it and who is involved in it?
It basically came about. It was developed by a consortium of organisations led initially by the RSPB, but also involving Bat Conservation Trust, Butterfly Conservation, Forestry Commission, Natural England, Plant Life, the Woodland Trust and the Silver Foundation. And it's an online resource for the conservation management of woodland. There's a lot of information about different woodland types, woodland species, and their ecology and everything that you would need to know about them to be able to manage your woodlands appropriately. So it really started about 10 11 years ago actually now. And it was initially a discussion between Forestry Commission down in the Southwest and a colleague of mine, Helen Booker. Forestry Commission were interested in discussing woodland birds after the Repeat Woodland Bird Survey, which was published a year or two before. And then that conversation developed with another colleague of ours, Nigel Symes, but it still very much had a Southwest focus. And then other organisations, such as Butterfly Conservation, Bat Conservation Trust, all kind of joined in that conversation. And they were called, basically came together and were called the Southwest Woodland Wildlife Initiative, really aimed at trying to get more woodland management for declining species. And then that evolved with the RSPB taking a bit of the lead, and the idea for the toolkit eventually emerged from those discussions. And then following that, the group decided that we really needed to broaden it out to a national remit to save repeating the efforts elsewhere. So that it really was an overarching thing rather than each sort of region or whatever doing something slightly different. And Natural England and Forestry Commission funded the early stages, and then we also brought in other experts for the other taxa groups. And the Silver Foundation were brought in to really help develop the website, and the RSPB and Woodland Trust sort of funded that part of it, and Silver look after the website for us. And so overall, it took about a decade to go from the early discussions to the launch in early 2019.
And who's the toolkit for, and why would they use it?
So the toolkit is for pretty much anyone who's interested in woodland habitats, species, or managing their woodlands for wildlife. And they would use it principally because it's just a really good one-stop shop for a huge amount of information on the woodland habitats, on the species, their ecology, the threats to them, different management options as to how you can try and mitigate that. But there is a huge amount of information in there.
And how will that tool help landowners manage their own woodlands?
So it will help because if they don't really know their woodlands, it provides them with an opportunity to search the toolkit, find out which of the priority species might be there. It doesn't definitely tell you that what is absolutely there, but it uses the data to find out what might be there, what they might need to think about to make sure that they're not making things worse for those species, but hopefully how to actually proactively manage in a positive manner and benefit those rare species. It provides some downloadable information about their ecology, again, their threats and the management options. And the really good thing is that it provides an opportunity to have a look at all the different species that you might have and shows you how you can do management to benefit all of them. So you're not literally just looking at one species alone. It will show you which management options will benefit a lot of the things that might be present and which ones you might need to do more particular one sort of management interventions just for one species or the other. So it does show you that synergy across the groups.
And I mean, I used the toolkit a few weeks ago and looked at woodlands near me. So unsurprisingly, looked at the bat bit. So I know where the bat data comes from, but where do all the different bits of data come from? And is there a risk that species could be missed given that it relies on the larger record centres, such as the National Bat Monitoring Programme, rather than local record centres, such as bat groups?
Yeah. So the for quite a lot of the groups, we got data directly from the taxa specialist organisation. So yes, the Bat Conservation Trust data provided the data for the bat species, which came through as distribution polygons for each species. The British Trust for Ornithology, we used their 2 kilometre square tetrad summary data from the last breeding bird atlas to get that information in for all of the key species, and then Butterfly Conservation provided actual grid references buffered around by a 2 kilometre square for both the butterflies and the moth species. So we are using national data as much as we can, and there's a whole load of other organisations that have provided information. We do get quite a lot from the NBN. I think realistically, there is always a risk that we might be missing species, but we are basically working with the best information we possibly can. It's always good to be able to go out or get people out to go and actually have a look at your woods and actually see what is actually there rather than just relying on the distribution data. And we would hope that, you know, even with local recorders, that would get fed into those record centres to help boost that national picture as well. So as well as just getting more of more information, if you could engage with your local back group to get that information, but if that could also be then fed into the local, the national or regional and national record centres, then that all helps to build that picture and make sure that the data that we are using is up to date and as accurate as possible. And that is one of the things that we know that we are going to need to do going forward, is to make sure that we are improving the timeliness or the up-to-dateness of the data that's in there, and where we can improve that resolution as well.
And I guess, like you say, you've been able to work with some record centres not giving you detailed grid references. So I guess if people are wanting to share data at a lower resolution, they could do that, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Great stuff. So finally, what's the long-term vision for the toolkit then?
So in the long run, we're aiming to, as I said, we're aiming to keep it up to date to make sure that it is all the information there is as up to date as possible. And that will include the data, the biological data, when we get more surveys, with all the research that's going on. And obviously, we've listened to quite a lot today on the various projects that around bat work and research into that. That's been amazing. But where we are finding out that more information, getting a clearer idea about which management interventions might work best for a particular species, will update those management options and all of that side of things as well. The key thing is to really try and promote it, get the message out there that this is available, and encourage people to try it out, learn how to use it, give us feedback so that we can improve and refine things as best as possible. And we are looking to develop a mobile app so that it's even more accessible, and that people could be out in the field and have this information actually with them whilst they're out walking around.
Great stuff. We'll put a link to the toolkit on the show notes as well. Gareth, thank you very much. That's great.
Thanks very much.
You can check out the Woodland Wildlife Toolkit for yourself to discover what woodland wildlife lives near you. The link is in the show notes. So Morgan Hughes, you're from Brumbats, and you've been granted a place here for a bursary. So do you just want to tell us a bit about yourself and what course you're studying at university?
I'm as you said, based in Birmingham, the Black Country. I've been a member of Brumbats for scarily over 15 years, but I'm currently doing a PhD at the University of Wolverhampton, looking at the assemblages and movements of urban bats.
How does that link in with the symposium? Why have you come along to this today then?
Because a lot of the bats that I'm looking at are in sort of woodlands in the urban fringe, so like the green belt, basically, what's left of it before it all gets rounded off and released. I'm looking at the bat assemblages of urban woodlands and weather and how easily they are crossing things like the M6 and M5, different parts of the conurbation.
And is that the main part of your PhD, or is that just one very small part of it?
Well, there's three bits. One is the assemblages and how much maybe the biometrics vary from area to area. Another is looking at specifically at Dorbentons and how they're using canals to get through and over the motorway barriers. And another is going to be looking at relatedness. So we're taking oral swabs and looking at DNA and comparing whether certain species are more genetically isolated than others because of the urban barriers.
Great stuff. So we're just about to come to the end of the first day, and it's a two-day conference. What were you hoping to learn at the start of the conference?
Well, I kind of have different things out of both days, really. So today's one I was really looking forward to the one about modifying acoustic lures, because obviously huge part of my research is based on whether I actually catch bats and whether I catch the species that specifically that I'm after. So that was really interesting. And then tomorrow I'm really interested in looking at the veteran tree stuff, but also the climate change stuff.
So what was the most interesting thing from today then? Which talk have you absorbed the most info from?
Definitely David Hill's talk about the lures. I found it really interesting, like looking at the different graphs, and shame on me, I haven't quite read that part of British Island Bats yet. So it was sitting on my desktop and I'm like, wait a minute, this is familiar. And I looked at it and yeah, it's fascinating just how like the different species will react. So like the brown long-eared bats seem to be really like predominantly attracted to their own calls, whereas some other species are a lot more catholic about what they're attracted to. Interesting.
Great stuff. So what would you say to people who are thinking about coming on to a Bat Conservation Trust conference but have never been to one before?
Oh, I think just dive in. I think that's I went to National Bat Conference in 2004 and knowing nothing about bats at all. I'd just taken on a job for the Wildlife Trust and I got sent sent off to National Bat Conference and then just came back completely hooked. The thing is, a passion of people and the kind of and everyone is so nice and everyone knows each other and respects each other so much, and it's just such a great opportunity to network and meet people and learn stuff, and it's great
stuff. Morgan Hughes, thank you very much. Vicky Bengtsson has been artificially veterinising trees in a number of countries, including England, Sweden and Norway. And in this next segment, she explains why and gives us the results of her extensive research. So, Vicky, you've just given a talk at the second day of the Woodland Symposium being organised by BCT. Do you just want to introduce yourself to the listeners?
I'm an ecologist and I have worked for about 30 years with nature conservation, and I've got a particular interest in old trees, veteran trees, ancient trees, wood pastures, and I now live in Sweden and I still work in the UK a bit.
So before we get on to the talk that you've just done and the veteranisation techniques that you're using, how would veteranisation of trees naturally happen out in the countryside?
Well, trees age. And as they age, fungi play a greater part in the process. So, for example, heartwood decay is one of the most important and valuable habitats that our old trees have. And we don't fully understand the mechanisms by which that happens, but we think that as the trees age, the heartwood is no longer functioning. And fungi then take advantage of that and decay it. And the same happens if you've got a dead branch, for example, fungi will decay the wood that's no longer functional. And that process creates all the things we're interested in for all sorts of species that live on or in and with old trees.
And I guess it depends on the tree species, but roughly how long does that process take in a tree's life to become a veteran tree?
There's actually a really good paper about oak, whereby they've shown at 200 years, 50% of oaks have some kind of cavity. At 300 years, 100% of the oaks have cavities. But I don't know of any other studies that show of other tree species. But my guess would be that birch, obviously, it happens much earlier in the process. We know with alder, for example, they develop cavities at a relatively young age, and it's often overlooked as a tree species that's got interesting cavities. And then pine, you know, guild. Your guess is as good as mine. So it varies a lot, really. And I don't know if we've got information about it either, really, to be honest.
So what are the techniques that you guys have been using to artificially create veteranization?
We are delighted to say that we've once again been selected by the Big Give for this year's Green Match Fund, which means every donation we receive will be doubled. This time around, we're raising funds for our science and research work, and we're hoping to raise £10,000, and the Big Give would match each donation made. Donations must be received via the Big Give website, which will go live on the 18th of April and will remain open for 1 week only until the 25th of April. Every donation will make a difference. We've put a link to the donation page in the show notes.
Well, I talked about five different techniques that we've used in a big trial. but I have a menu, which is more like 15 different techniques, more or less different, creating lightning strikes, creating kind of slits, if you like, in the tree, topping them, you know, fracturing branches, doing flush cuts. And that one's one that people absolutely think is awful, given that in the kind of 70s and 80s, it was the way to do tree surgery and became absolutely not the way to do tree surgery. But actually, we've got really good data on flush cuts developing decay. So it's a brilliant technique to use. But creating cavities, I think, is the one that's been most interesting to me. And I think that's what's providing us with the best outcome as well, I suppose. And the cavities are the things that also take the longest time to create.
So, I mean, where's the need for this come from? What's the advantage of doing these artificial techniques?
Well, where do you start? I mean, for the last, 200 years, we've created a landscape that's pretty intensive in agriculture, forestry, and our natural habitats have reduced and reduced and reduced. So they're now fragmented in small isolated pockets. We've often got, you know, wood pastures that are either overgrown or are very few old trees left. And it seems to me like it's a no-brainer. We need to do something. If we do nothing, we know what's going to happen. We're going to lose species as those old trees die. And we have to wait 200-300 years, as I've said with oak, that it takes for those cavities to form. And if you've got an age gap, then we can't afford to wait. So I would say that it's an essential additional tool in our nature conservation management toolbox to help us bridge some of those gaps that we've created due to the use of our landscape over the last 150 years. And that we should use the resources available to us. So the example that I gave in my talk was when you've got an old tree, say that's 300-400 years old, that's got overgrown because of lack of grazing, and you've got trees that are say 50 to 70 years old that you would want to remove anyway to create more light for that old tree. Well, instead of removing the trees, if we damage them a bit instead, they won't compete quite as strongly with the old trees. So you do that. Plus, potentially and hopefully, we'll also create some habitats that you otherwise find in the old trees in a younger tree. So that's the whole, you know, the whole idea, really.
So just before we get onto the results, whereabouts have you been trialing this then?
Well, I started with it at Hatfield Forest, National Trust site in Essex. And I know that there's been some done at Windsor, and Lynn Boddy's been doing some of her work at Windsor and at Savernack. Bernard Beaches have done some, but the big trial that we've done is in Sweden, Norway, and in England. We've got three sites in England, one in Norway, and 16 in Sweden. So mostly, I think that I know of anyway, has been in England and in Sweden where it's really taken off. But in Lithuania, they've been doing some work for the hermit beetle species. And in Italy, they've done some work on red oak, which is an invasive species. So they've been veterinising those trees as an alternative to removing them. And in Australia, they've been doing some work on veterinisation as well. But me, I've been, I think, limited, if you like, to England, Sweden and Norway.
I mean, I feel like that's quite enough, is it? and got that. So has it been successful? You know, what have the results shown? Does it work?
The short answer to that is yes. I think, as I said also in my talk, that I've had, you know, someone sitting on my shoulder saying, are these just really expensive bird boxes? You know, and I think it's a very fair question. But I think I feel confident now that we're on the right track, that the work we're doing is mimicking natural cavities, because we understand tree physiology. So we understand that it's about creating dysfunction in the tree that then allows the fungi to do what they need to do, which in turn then allows other species to come in. So the evidence we've got from looking at the trees after 8 years gives me a pretty strong steer that we're on the right track. I mean, firstly, we've had 70% of the cavities we've created have had birds nesting in, and they leave in turn bird nesting material, dead birds, eggshells, and we know that that attracts other species. Then we've also found live bats. We've also found remains from bats, so insect remains from brown long-eared, and obviously bat droppings as well. Massively under-recorded, I would think, because I'm not a bat person, and we visited those trees on one occasion. So, you know, they're bound to be under-recorded. Then also tree ants, which I think are one of these kind of, you know, crucial keystone species in cavity ecology and decay processes. So the fact that we've got all of that happening gives me much more confidence in the technique and also which techniques. So the horse damage that we've created, which is the kind of exposed wood at the base of the trunk, we're getting decay happening in those. And I think that's the butt rot, if you like, that we're after there. And that's beginning to show signs of that happening. And then the cavities that we've created are actually showing also that they're being used by the species that are of interest to us. So yes, I think some of the other techniques where we've been like ring barking branches, for example, I don't think I would continue with, because we looked at the trees, the control trees, and they are creating dead branches of the same size in the same time frame. So, but that's useful knowledge as well. So I think that's what I would say, that we now can kind of narrow in a little bit more into which of the techniques are giving us the results that we want, or alternatively, that help us understand which techniques to choose depending on what our target groups are.
I found it quite interesting looking at the photos that you had, was that when they're quite fresh cuts, they're quite, some people would say, quite ugly. You know, you've got fresh chainsaw marks, but actually it didn't take many years for the tree to naturally heal and sort of smooth things over, did it?
It's amazing, actually. I mean, trees don't heal in that sense, but they do respond amazingly well. And because we're working with young trees, that's particularly obvious. And I think what was very interesting is the nest boxes that we did in this trial in 2012, they looked like letter boxes when we were finished. And as you say, they kind of looked a bit odd. But now when you go, I mean, people don't see them. You know, I walk around with people and I'm like, that tree's done, that tree's done, that, can you not see that cavity? And it's only like, oh yeah. Oh, you know, so that's the other thing that's a real benefit, in that it makes it easier to, if you like, sell it in to people who may not be professionals working with this, but even professionals actually. But, you know, it's a good way to show, well, actually, if you do this carefully, it looks very much like a natural feature. I mean, particularly the woodpecker holes. I defy anyone to come and look at some of those trees with me who don't know to say that's done with a chainsaw, because it's hard enough for me, and I know which trees have been done and they've got tags on and I've taken photographs before, you know. So I think it's a real positive outcome.
And for anyone who's worried, you did this to a vast number of trees and you only had a very small percentage of them actually died, didn't you? It was less than 2% of the trees that actually died from it.
And that was a real surprise to me, actually, to be honest, because I thought even some of the control trees would have died in that time, because, you know, we've got very little data on tree mortality of oak in more like wood pasture situations. We've got good forestry data, but not good data on trees in wood pasture situations. So I expected more trees to have died than that, to be honest, even if a couple of them are none of them are control trees, which is interesting in its own right. All of them are trees that we've treated, but some of them are trees where we've just ring barked the branch. So I don't really think that has anything to do with the treatment that we did. So, a few trees. And that was the idea. I hope that they wouldn't die. I expect some to, obviously, but of other reasons. But, yeah.
So, Vicky, if people want to find out more about your work, where's the best place for them to go?
Sadly enough, that's a bit more tricky, because I've been a bit rubbish at publishing stuff. Because, you know, I've got a day job, and I hope next year that we'll get something out, you know, a full publication on the results that we've done. But I did write an article in Conservation Land Management in 2015, which outlined all the techniques, the menu that I mentioned. And I hope next year to do something more. But we have got a paper being published about the fungi data that I talked about too, which is in press actually. So that'll be out soon. If you go to the VetCert website, there's a nice little film there about veterinisation.
Vicky, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And in the next series of Bat Chat, we'll be revisiting the work of Jim Mulholland, when I'll be joining him out in the field, observing some of those techniques that Vicky just described taking place. Rob Coventry is the Forestry Commission's Woodland Resilience Officer, and here we discuss the potential future outcomes of ash dieback in the UK and what it might mean for bats. So we're just in the lunch break of the second day of the Woodland Symposium, and Rob Coventry's kindly joined me. Rob, do you just want to introduce yourself to the listeners and what your job title is and what you actually do for the day job?
Yeah, hi Steve, thanks. So my job title's Woodland Resilience Officer. It's a new post created by the Forestry Commission a couple of years ago. And the kind of the main brief is to help the woodland sector respond to ash dieback and increase the resilience of their woodlands kind of simultaneously. Primarily in the southeast of England, that's my patch, but I also feed into international guidance and policy on those sort of topics.
So your talk was on the ash dieback, the Killara pandemic, if you like, that we're seeing in the UK at the moment. Can you just give us a crash course, if there's such a thing, in ash dieback? What is it, how it arrived, what the known spread is so far?
Sure. So it was first found in the UK in 2012. But subsequently, we've worked out that it was here since at least 2005 and probably much earlier. It was first discovered in Europe in 2006, I think it was, or at least the mid-2000s. And there they've worked out it's been there since the early 1990s, at least. So it's an invasive fungal pathogen that's originated from East Asia, where it kind of lives on the Fraxinus, sorry, the ash species over there, and it causes them a lot less damage over there, actually. So anyway, it's moved around on wind blown spore masses. It overwinters in the leaf litter of the ash and the fruits from there, and then it moves on the wind either to infect the foliage above. Where the cycle then kind of continues, or it can blow a bit further on the wind. So the idea is that it arrived here, it actually arrived here both on imported planting stock. So there were some isolated outbreaks in different parts of the country, but also most likely on wind-blown spore masses across from the continent as well, which would have hit particularly the southeast first. And East Anglia, and that's why the disease has been slightly more progressed in those areas.
So can you describe the likely effects of Killara or ash dieback in the future? What do you think our landscapes will look like? Have we got any idea of that?
No one's entirely certain exactly how it will play out in UK conditions. We've taken a bit of a, you know, we can take advice from Europe where they're a few years ahead of us. It's kind of anecdotal evidence suggests there's a 10-year lag period between early signs of infection and widespread mortality. And so, as I said, in the southeast, we're kind of well past that already, and we're seeing this widespread mortality. Other parts of the country may be a few years behind, but it can pick up quite quickly. So I do think right now is certainly the southeast. Southwest. It's starting to hit that area a lot harder, and I think other parts of the country too, and that will continue kind of north and west. In terms of the kind of local, the more local impact, I think that varies depending on the landscape setting and the density of ash. So the worst impacts are likely to be in ash-dense woodlands, where conditions are really good for the fungus, and it can build up that kind of volumes of sporulating material in the leaf litter. The mortality levels are going to be quite high. It's very difficult to predict what they will be. Outside of woodlands, and especially further away from higher densities of ash, the trees may still show some signs of infection, but there is a possibility that they will kind of survive indefinitely and tolerate the disease, because it's the compound stresses on the tree combined with the pressure from the fungus. And outside of woodlands, that pressure will be dramatically less. Overall, Richard Buggs, who's done a lot of work on the genetics of the disease and of ash at Kew and the Queen Mary, I think it is, he's suggested that it's likely that we will lose 50% of our ash trees, which is obviously a very high amount, but he can't confidently say more than that.
from where I am in Derbyshire, quite a lot of some of the important bat habitats are within Ash Woodlands, particularly up in the Peak District, where we've got lots of underground sites which we know are used by mating bats for autumn swarming. They all occur, all these mines and cave sites are often on steep wooded valleys, which, you know, since the mining activity has ceased, have become predominantly ash woodlands. Do we have any idea, do you think, of what the impact will be for those woodlands? I mean, you've sort of touched on it there and said we think that where you've got heavily dense ash woodlands, they're going to be the worst affected. Do we have any idea whether if those ash trees die back, whether other species will take their place, or do we think those landscapes are just going to become decimated?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think a lot depends on the local setting, the density of ash in proportion to other species, and the management that's kind of delivered there. So as you say, they're ash-dense woodlands, and they're in kind of deep, moist valleys often. And I'm afraid to say that is, based on the kind of the limited advice and evidence that's out there, they are highly susceptible to the disease. So it's quite likely that, you know, over a number of years, much of the ash in those woodlands will be lost. As for what returns, well, obviously, so, I mean, there's some ups and downs of management in terms of how it affects bat habitat. But one thing management can do, if removing those trees or beginning the process of removing those trees before the entire stand collapses, it can ensure, you know, some canopy or trees are restocked, and we can retain some level of canopy as much as possible in the situation. But and I think natural regeneration, both from ash and from other species, would be an ideal scenario in many settings, many sort of conservation orientated for management objectives. I think that's a really in terms of maintaining ash in the landscape, that is a really important kind of approach to conservation, retaining any trees that show signs of tolerance, and then the difficult bit, cultivating natural regeneration from them. But also from other species that are around that may replace ash. But that, ash tends to be on quite rich sites, and they're some of the more challenging ones for kind of actively cultivating natural regeneration on. And also we have such high deer levels that they really inhibit natural regeneration and the kind of adaptive processes that come with it. Unfortunately, so managing deer in these woodlands is going to be really crucial for their ongoing maintenance of the woodland cover.
So, like you said, sounds like management is the key thing here. Is there information out there for landowners to get this sort of information so they can start that management planning and process now?
There's a proliferation almost of ash dieback guidance. Certainly, I'm more familiar with the Forestry Commission stuff, obviously. You can get that on gov.uk. So there's three Forestry Commission operations notes on gov.uk, which look at managing woodlands affected by ash dieback, managing non-woodland trees, and then restocking woodlands. They're the three operations notes. So there are kind of core guidance. We have a more easy reading note which signposts to various organisations and guidance which is relevant to landowners and managers, and that's on the Forest Research website. Also on the Forest Research website is a really good Kalara manual, it's called, and that's got an abundance of information on managing ash in different settings, and of course the research that's been going on ash. It links through to that. In terms of there's a case study document produced by the RFS and the Forestry Commission. That's on the RFS website, and that's called Managing Ash Dieback Case Studies, I think. And that shows some examples of different approaches, that case studies where owners have actually, you know, been undertaking management. Oh, another one. There's a great Forestry Commission and Natural England document on managing ash in SSSIs. That's probably quite a useful one where conservation is a key objective. And then there's some other useful bits and bobs from the Tree Council and the Arboricultural Association and things like that for more sort of specific areas.
So all these different documents just mentioned there, you know, we never had anything like that for Dutch elm disease. Is this a reaction of that disease from Dutch elm disease? Have we learned lessons from there, or is it just because technology has caught up and we're able to get all this information out there sooner?
I mean, I think we did learn some lessons from the Dutch elm disease. Actually, when I started this job, I was looking into some of the Forestry Commission reports on lessons learned from the Dutch elm disease response. But I think probably now we have I'm not sure how big a component in the landscape elm was, whether it was as big as ash. I suspect it probably was, actually. But ash is obviously a huge proportion of, I think it's 12% of our broadleaf woodland or something like that, and a similar proportion of non-woodland trees. So it's absolutely huge kind of impact. I think now we probably have more of an understanding of the ecological complexity of different species and the implications that losing one of them might have on a whole array of aspects of ecosystem functioning and biodiversity. So certainly a lot of the research effort has gone into understanding the ecological implications of losing ash, as well, of course, of how to preserve it and how to develop a breeding program.
Great stuff. Rob Coventry, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
I've just been joined by Aleri Kent, who's had a bursary to attend this 2-day woodland symposium. So, Aleri, do you want to introduce yourself and just tell us about the course you're studying and at which uni?
Yeah, hi. I'm doing a PhD in Stirling at the moment, I've just started a couple months ago, and I'm going to be researching how landscape context affects woodland use by bats. And the aim is that hopefully the kind of knowledge we get from that can then help inform the best places to put sort of reforestation projects.
Are you looking at lots of different bat species or just focusing on one or two?
We're going to be looking at lots of them. I think the main project we're going to do is with passive detectors, put out and sort of see what bats we get in different forests. So we're probably going to get mostly data from pipistrelles, but we hopefully will get data from some other ones as well and get to look at them as well.
So what is it that's made you want to come along to this symposium then?
Yeah, it's closely related to the project I'm doing. Like, it's about bats and woodlands, so it's pretty close to what I'm doing. And it's just really cool to see what other people are doing on similar topics, get an idea of what's going on. You know, there were some talks yesterday about big passive bat monitoring projects as well, which were really interesting to hear about and see what they're doing and kind of pick up tips from people as well about how they're managing their data and stuff like that. It's been really cool.
And was there anything you were hoping to learn at the start of the conference in particular?
I think just kind of getting an idea, because I've only just started the PhD, I'm kind of still getting an idea of what we already know, what we need to find out. I think I was mostly just kind of looking to get an overview, but I've learned a lot already, so it's really cool.
So which talk so far have you found the most useful, or have you absorbed the most information from?
The one I found most useful was Sonia's, Sonia Ravelry, who was talking about a big project they did with the Public Forest Estate down in the southwest, which was looking at using passive monitoring and seeing what bats they had in different woodlands and kind of which species that were really good to pick up. And I think there was some really interesting stuff there as well about what AI can do now with bat data. Like, I was so surprised. She's like, yeah, we had something like 5 terabytes of data, which was slightly terrifying given I'm doing a similar project, hoping to do a similar project soon. But she's like, yeah, and then we just fed it through some AI and they sort of sorted it out for us a bit. And I was like, oh, cool. I didn't know that we had like machine learning stuff that could do things that cool yet. So that was really interesting, yeah.
Yeah, you'll definitely need a big hard drive to store your data, yeah, I'm telling you now. And what would you say to people who have never been to a Bat Conservation Trust conference before and are thinking about dipping their toes in? What would you say to them if they're thinking about doing that?
I think definitely go for it. Like, it's really interesting. I've learned so much. You know, and it's a really nice range as well of some academic people who are doing more sort of focused research and just people who are interested and sort of have their own perspective as well. So sort of, you know, I'm thinking about it from the science, and then some people are like, well, how can I help this bat roost in my area kind of thing. And it's just like that range of perspectives, I think, really gives it a lot. It like brings up lots of interesting issues, and there's lots of interesting back and forth between sort of the research and the more practical side of it. And I really enjoyed that part of it.
Great stuff. Well, best of luck with the PhD, Ilary, and we'll look forward to seeing how it goes. My thanks to George, Morgan, Vicky, Rob and Ilary for taking time out of the symposium to make those recordings with me. The links to the various topics discussed are in the show notes. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode of Bat Chat. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time for our final episode of this second series, talking about bats and churches. Catch you then. Now, lots of you have seen me in branded t-shirts and hoodies with the Bat Chat logo on, and you've all been asking me when they'll be available. Well, we're thrilled to let you know that a whole range of Bat Chat clothing and tote bags is now available for you on our T-Mill store. The link's in the show notes. Whether you're a long-time supporter or a new member of the Bat Chat family, we can't wait for you to share your photos of you wearing our merch on social media. Be sure to tag the Bat Conservation Trust in your posts. If you're listening to Bat Chat on Google Podcasts, we wanted to let you know that Google have announced they plan to discontinue their app later this year, so we recommend making the switch to an alternative podcast app, and we've put some links in the show notes to alternative apps that you can follow Bat Chat on so that you don't miss any future episodes.